whole front ride now one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. We will be reading again this week from The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. This book was published in Boston and New York by Houghton Mifflin and Company in 1903. The Log of a Cowboy is an autobiographical account of a five-month drive of 3,100 cattle from Brownsville, Texas to the Blackfeet Indian Agency in Montana in 1882 along the Great Western Cattle Trail. The cattle belonged to Don Lovell, the renowned cowman and drover, though he is not along for the drive, entrusting that responsibility to his experienced foreman, Jim Flood. Adams' log is a classic and authentic description of trail men and their work, cow horses, and range cattle. Although strictly speaking, the book is fiction, it is firmly based on Adams' personal experiences on the trail, and it is considered by many to be the best account of cowboy life in literature. At this point in our story, Andy and his crew of cowpokes have brought their Circle Dot herd, originally assembled from numerous Mexican rancheros, across the Rio Grande, dealt with rustlers, struggled to contain two stampedes, negotiated with one group of Indians while avoiding others, labored through a perilous crossing of the South Branch of the Canadian River in Oklahoma, and barely survived a couple of nights and days of carousing in the wide-open cattle town of Dodge City, Kansas. They are now ready to head north again from Dodge. I remind you that our stories are usually edited for recording. Herds bound for points beyond the Yellowstone in Montana always considered Dodge as the halfway landmark on the trail, though we had hardly covered half the distance to the destination of our Circle Dots. But with Dodge in our rear, all felt that the backbone of the drive was broken, and it was only the middle of June. In order to divide the night work more equitably, for the remainder of the trip, the first and the fourth guards changed, the second and the third remaining as they were. We had begun to feel the scarcity of wood for cooking purposes some time past, and while crossing the plains of western Kansas, we were frequently forced to resort to the old bed grounds of a year or two previous for cattle chips. These chips were a poor substitute for wood, and we swung a cowskin under the reach of the wagon so that when we encountered wood on creeks and rivers, we could lay in a supply. Whenever our wagon was in the rear, the riders on either side of the herd were always on the skirmish for fuel, which they left alongside the wagon track, and our cook was sure to stow it away underneath on the cowskin. In spite of any effort on our part, the length of the days made long drives the rule. The cattle could be depended on to leave the bed ground at dawn, and before the outfit could breakfast, secure mounts, and overtake the herd, they would often have grazed forward 2 to 3 miles. Often, we never threw them on the trail at all. Yet when it came time to bed them at night, we had covered 20 miles. They were long, monotonous days, for we were always 16 to 18 hours in the saddle, while in emergencies we got the benefit of the limit. We frequently saw mirages, though we were never led astray by shady groves of timber or tempting lakes of water, but always kept within a mile or two of the trail. Quince Forrest had gone ahead to scout the trail, and on the evening of the third day after he left us, he returned as we were bedding down the cattle at dusk, and on being assured that no officers of the law had followed us, resumed his place with the herd. You'll remember that Quince had gotten into a bit of a scrape in Dodge City and had eluded Dodge's peace officers, but was afraid that they might have pursued him. He had not even reached the Solomon River, but it stopped with a herd of millets on Big Boggy. This creek he reported is bottomless, and the millet herd is having lost between 40 and 50 head of cattle in attempting to force it at the regular crossing the day before his arrival. They had scouted the creek both up and down since, without finding a safe crossing. It seemed that there had been unusually heavy June rains through that section, which accounted for the Boggy being in its dangerous condition. Millet's foreman had not considered it necessary to test such an insignificant stream until he got a couple of hundred head of cattle floundering in the mire. They had saved the greater portion of the mired cattle, but quite a number were trampled to death by the others, and now the regular crossing was not approachable for the stench of dead cattle. Flood knew the stream, and so did a number of our outfit, but none of them had any idea that it could get into such an impassable condition as Forrest reported. The next morning, our foreman Flood started to the east, and Priest to the west, to look out a crossing, for we were then within a half-day's drive of the creek. Big Boggy paralleled the Solomon River in our front, the two not being more than 5 miles apart. The confluence was far below in some settlements, and we must keep to the westward of all immigration, on account of the growing crops in the fertile valley of the Solomon. On the westward, had a favorable crossing been found, we would almost have had to turn our herd backward, for we were already within the half-circle which this creek described in our front. So, after the two men left us, we allowed the herd to graze forward, keeping several miles to the westward of the trail in order to get the benefit of the best grazing. Our herd, when left to itself, would graze from a mile to a mile and a half an hour, and by the middle of the forenoon, the timber on Big Boggy and the Solomon beyond was sighted. On reaching this last divide, someone sighted a herd about 5 to 6 miles to the eastward and nearly parallel with us. As they were 3 to 4 miles beyond the trail, we could easily see that they were grazing along like ourselves, and Forrest was appealed to know if it was the millet herd. He said not, and pointed out to the northeast about the location of the millet cattle, probably 5 miles in advance of the stranger on our right. When we overtook our wagon at noon, McCann, who had never left the trail, reported having seen the herd. They looked to him like heavy beef cattle, and had 2 yoke of oxen to their chuck wagon, which served further to proclaim them as strangers. Neither Priest nor Flood returned during the noon hour, and when the herd refused to lie down and rest longer, we grazed them forward till the fringe of timber which grew along the stream loomed up not a mile distant in our front. From the course we were traveling, we would strike the creek several miles above the regular crossing, and as Forrest reported that millet was holding below the old crossing on a small rivulet, all we could do was to hold our wagon in the rear and await the return of our men out on scout for a ford. Priest was the first to return, with word that he had ridden the creek out for 25 miles and had found no crossing that would be safe for a mud turtle. On hearing this, we left 2 men with the herd, and the rest of the outfit took the wagon, went on to the Boggy, and made camp. It was a deceptive-looking stream, not over 50 or 60 feet wide. In places, the current barely moved, shallow and deepening, from a few inches in places to several feet in others, with an occasional pool that would swim a horse. We probed it with poles until we were satisfied that we were up against a proposition different from anything we had yet encountered. While we were discussing the situation, a stranger rode up on a fine roan horse and inquired for our foreman. Forrest informed him that our boss was away looking for a crossing, but we were expecting his return at any time, and invited the stranger to dismount. He did so, and threw himself down in the shade of our wagon. He was a small, boyish-looking fellow, of sandy complexion, not much, if any, over 20 years old, and smiled continuously. "My name is Pete Slaughter," said he, by way of introduction, "and I've got a herd of 2,800 beef steers beyond the trail and a few miles back. I've been riding since daybreak down the creek, and I'm prepared to state that the chance of crossing is as good right here as anywhere. I wanted to see your foreman, and if he'll help, we'll bridge her. I've been down to see this other outfit, but they ridicule the idea, though I think they'll come around all right. I borrowed their axe, and tomorrow morning you'll see me with my outfit cutting timber to bridge Big Boggy. That's right, boys. It's the only thing to do. The trouble is, I've only got 8 men all told. I don't aim to travel over 8 to 10 miles a day, so I don't need a big outfit. You say your foreman's name is Flood? Well, if he don't return before I go, some of you tell him that he's wasting a good time looking for a ford, for there ain't none." In the conversation which followed, we learned that Slaughter was driving for his brother Lum, a widely known cowman and drover, whom we had seen in Dodge. He had started with the grass from North Texas, and by the time he reached the Platte, many of his herd would be fit to ship to market, and what were not would be in good demand as feeders in the corn belt of eastern Nebraska. He asked if we had seen his herd during the morning, and on hearing we had, got up and asked McCann to let him see our axe. This he gave a critical examination before he mounted his horse to go, and on leaving, said, "If your foreman don't want to help build a bridge, I want to borrow that axe of yours. But you fellas talk to him. If any of you boys has ever been over on the Chisholm Trail, you'll remember the bridge on Rush Creek, south of the Washita River. I built that bridge in a day with an outfit of 10 men. Why, shucks, if these outfits had pulled together, we could cross tomorrow evening. Lots of these old foremen don't like to listen to a cub like me, but holy snakes, I've been over the trail oftener than any of them. Why, when I wasn't big enough to make a hand with the herd, only 10 years old, in the days when we drove to Abilene, they used to send me in the lead with an old cylinder gun to shoot at the buffalo and scare them off the trail, and I've made the trip every year since. So, you tell Flood when he comes in that Pete Slaughter was here and that he's going to build a bridge, and would like to have him and his outfit help." Had it not been for his youth and perpetual smile, we might have taken young Slaughter more seriously, for both Quince Forrest and the Rebel remembered the bridge on Rush Creek over the Chisholm. Still, there was an air of confident assurance in the young fellow, and the fact that he was the trusted foreman of Lum Slaughter, in charge of a valuable herd of cattle, carried weight with those who knew that drover. The most unwelcome thought in the project was that it required the swinging of an axe to fell trees and to cut them into the necessary lengths. And, as I've said before, the Texan never took kindly to manual labor. But Priest looked favorably on the suggestion, and so enlisted my support, and even pointed out a spot where timber was most abundant as a suitable place to build the bridge. "Hell's fire," said Joe Stallings, with infinite contempt. "There's thousands of places to build a bridge, and the timber's there, but the idea is to cut it." And his sentiments found a hearty approval by the majority of the outfit. Flood returned late that evening, having ridden as far down the creek as the first settlement. The Rebel, somewhat antagonized by the attitude of the majority, reported the visit and message left for him by young Slaughter. Our foreman knew him by general reputation amongst trail bosses, and when Priest vouched for him as the builder of the Rush Creek Bridge on the Chisholm Trail, Flood said, "Why, I crossed my herd 4 years ago on that Rush Creek Bridge within a week after it was built. I wondered who it could be that had the nerve to undertake that task. Rush isn't over half as wide a bayou as old Boggy, but she's a true little sister to this miry slough. So he's going to build a bridge anyhow, is he?" The next morning, young Slaughter was at our camp before sunrise, and never once mentioning his business or waiting for the formality of an invitation, proceeded to pour out a tin cup of coffee and otherwise provide himself with a substantial breakfast. There was something amusing in the audacity of the fellow, which all of us liked, though he was 15 years the junior of our foreman. McCann pointed out Flood to him, and, taking his well-loaded plate, he went over and sat down by our foreman, and while he ate, talked rapidly to enlist our outfit in the building of the bridge. During breakfast, the outfit listened to the two bosses as they discussed the feasibility of the project. Slaughter enthusiastic, Flood reserved, and asking all sorts of questions as to the mode of procedure. Young Pete met every question with promptness and assured our foreman that the building of bridges was his long suit. After breakfast, the two foremen rode off down the creek together, and within half an hour, Slaughter's wagon and remuda pulled up within sight of the regular crossing, and shortly afterwards, our foreman returned and ordered our wagon to pull down to a clump of cottonwoods which grew about a half a mile below our camp. Two men were detailed to look after our herd during the day, and the remainder of us returned with our foreman to the site selected for the bridge. On our arrival, three axes were swinging against as many cottonwoods, and there was no doubt in anyone's mind that we were going to be under a new foreman, for that day at least. Slaughter had a big cook, who swung an axe in a manner which bespoke him a job for the day, and McCann was instructed to provide dinner for the extra outfit. The site chosen for the bridge was a miry bottom over which oozed 3 to 4 inches of water, where the width of the stream was about 60 feet, with solid banks on either side. To get a good foundation was the most important matter, but the brush from the trees would supply the material for that. Within an hour, brush began to arrive, dragged from the pommels of saddles, and was piled into the stream. About this time, a call went out for a volunteer who could drive oxen, for their cook was too good an axeman to be recalled. As I had driven oxen as a boy, I was going to offer my services, when Joe Stallings eagerly volunteered in order to avoid using an axe. Slaughter had some extra chain, and our four mules were pressed into service as an extra team in snaking logs. As McCann was to provide for the inner man, the mule team fell to me, and putting my saddle on the nigh wheeler, I rode jauntily past Mr. Stallings as he trudged alongside his two yoke of oxen. About 10 o'clock in the morning, George Jacklin, the foreman of the millet herd, rode up with several of his men, and seeing the bridge taking shape, turned in and assisted in dragging brush for the foundation. By the time all hands knocked off for dinner, we had a foundation of brush 20 feet wide and 4 feet high, to say nothing about what had sunk in the mire. The logs were cut about 14 feet long, and old Joe and I had snaked them up as fast as the axeman could get them ready. Jacklin returned to his wagon for dinner and a change of horses, though Slaughter, with plenty of assurance, had invited him to eat with us, and when he declined had remarked, with no less confidence, "Well then, you'll be right back after dinner. And say, bring all the men you can spare, and if you got any gunny sacks or old tarpaulins, bring 'em. And by all means, don't forget your spade." Pete Slaughter was a harsh master, considering he was working volunteer labor. But we all felt a common interest in the bridge, for if Slaughter's beeves could cross, ours could, and so could Millet's. All the men dragging brush changed horses during dinner, for there was to be no pause in piling in a good foundation as long as the material was at hand. Jacklin and his outfit returned, 10 strong, and with 30 men at work, the bridge grew. They began laying the logs on the brush after dinner, and the work of sodding the bridge went forward at the same time. The bridge stood about 2 feet above the water in the creek, but when near the middle of the stream was reached, the foundation gave way, and for an hour, 10 horses were kept busy dragging brush to fill that sinkhole until it would bear the weight of the logs. We'd used all the acceptable timber on our side of the stream for half a mile either way, and yet there were not enough logs to complete the bridge. When we lacked only some 10 or 12 logs, Slaughter had the boys sawed a narrow strip across the remaining brush, and the horsemen led their mounts across to the farther side. Then the axemen crossed, felled the nearest trees, and the logs were dragged up from the pommels of our saddles. It now remained only to saw it over and dirt the bridge thoroughly. With only 3 spades, the work was slow, but we cut sod with axes, and after several hours' work, had it finished. The 2 yoke of oxen were driven across and back for a test, and the bridge stood it nobly. Slaughter then brought up his remuda, and while the work of dirting the bridge was still going on, crossed and recrossed his band of saddle horses 20 times. When the bridge looked completed to everyone else, young Pete advised laying stringers across on either side. So a number of small trees were felled and guardrails strung across the ends of the logs and staked. Then more dirt was carried in on tarpaulins and in gunny sacks, and every chink and crevice filled with sod and dirt. It was now getting late in the afternoon, but during the finishing touches, young Slaughter had dispatched his outfit to bring up his herd, and at the same time, Flood had sent a number of our outfit to bring up our cattle. Now, Slaughter and the rest of us took the oxen, which we had unyoked, and went about a quarter of a mile to meet his herd coming up. Turning the oxen in the lead, young Pete took one point and Flood the other, and pointed in the lead cattle for the bridge. On reaching it, the cattle hesitated for a moment, and it looked as though they were going to balk. But finally one of the oxen took the lead, and they began to cross in almost Indian file. They were big 4 or 5 year old beeves, and too many of them on the bridge at one time might have sunk it. But Slaughter rode back down the line of cattle and called to the men to hold them back. "Don't crowd the cattle," he shouted. "Give them all the time they want. We're in no hurry now. There's lots of time." They were a full half hour in crossing, the chain of cattle taking the bridge never for a moment being broken. Once all were over, his men rode to the lead and turned the herd up the boggy, in order to have it well out of the way of ours, which were then looming up in sight. Slaughter asked Flood if he wanted the oxen, and as our cattle had never seen a bridge in their lives, the foreman decided to use them. So we brought them back and met the herd, now strung out nearly a mile. Our cattle were naturally wild, but we turned the oxen in the lead, and the 2 bosses again taking the points, moved the herd up to the bridge. The oxen were again slow to lead out in crossing, and several 100 head of cattle had congested in front of the new bridge, making us all rather nervous, when a big white ox led off, his mate following, and the herd began timidly to follow. Our cattle required careful handling, and not a word was spoken as we nursed them forward or rode through them to scatter large bunches. A number of times, we cut the train of cattle off entirely, as they were congesting at the bridge entrance, and, in crossing, shied and crowded so that several were forced off the bridge into the mire. Our herd crossed in considerably less time than did Slaughter's beeves, but we had 5 head to pull out. This, however, was considered nothing, as they were light and the mire was as thin as soup. Our wagon and saddle horses crossed while we were pulling out the bogged cattle, and about half the outfit, taking the herd, drifted them forward towards the Solomon. Since Millet intended crossing that evening, herds were likely to be too thick for safety at night. The sun was hardly an hour high when the last herd came up to cross. The oxen were put in the lead, as with ours, and all 4 of the oxen took the bridge. but when the cattle reached the bridge, they made a decided balk and refused to follow the oxen. Not a hoof of the herd would even set foot on the bridge. The oxen were brought back several times, but in spite of all coaxing and nursing, and our best endeavors and devices, they would not risk it. We worked with them until dusk, when all three of the foremen decided it was useless to try longer, but both Slaughter and Flood promised to bring back part of their outfits in the morning and make another effort. McCann's campfire piloted us to our wagon, at least 3 miles from the bridge, for he had laid in a good supply of wood during the day. On our arrival, our night horses were tied up, and everything made ready for the night. The next morning, we started the herd, but Flood took 4 of us with him and went back to Big Boggy. The millet herd was nearly 2 miles back from the bridge, where we found Slaughter at Jacklin's wagon, and several more of his men were, we learned, coming over with the oxen at about 10 a.m. That hour was considered soon enough by the bosses, as the heat of the day would be on the herd by that time, which would make them lazy. When the oxen arrived at the bridge, we rode out 20 strong and lined the cattle up for another trial. They grazed until they were full and sleepy. But the memory of some of them was too vivid of the hours they had spent in the slimy ooze of Big Boggy once on a time, and they began milling on side of the stream. We took them back and brought them up a second time with the same results. We then brought them around in a circle a mile in diameter, and as the rear end of the herd was passing, we turned the last 100, and throwing the oxen into their lead, started them for the bridge, but they too sulked and would have none of it. It was now high noon, so we turned the herd again and allowed them to graze back while we went to dinner. Millet's foreman was rather discouraged with the outlook, but Slaughter said they must be crossed if he had to lay over a week and help. After dinner, Jacklin asked us if we wanted a change of horses, and as we could see a 20-mile ride ahead of us in overtaking our herd, Flood accepted. When all was ready to start, Slaughter made his suggestion. "Let's go out," he said, "and bring them up slowly in a solid body. And when we get them opposite the bridge, round them in gradually as if we were going to bed them down. I'll take a long lariat to my white wheeler, and when they've quieted down perfectly, I'll lead old Blanco through them and across the bridge, and possibly they'll follow. There's no use crowding them, for that only excites them, and if you ever start them milling, the jig's up. They're nice, gentle cattle, but they've been balked once, and they haven't forgotten it." What we needed right then was a leader, for we were all ready to catch at a straw, and Slaughter's suggestion was welcome, for he had established himself in our good graces until we preferred him to either of the other foremen as a leader. Riding out to the herd, which were lying down, we roused and started them back towards Old Boggy. While drifting them back, we covered a front a quarter of a mile in width, and as we neared the bridge, we gave them perfect freedom. Slaughter had caught out his white ox, and we gradually worked them into a body, covering perhaps 10 acres in front of the bridge. Several small bunches attempted to mill, but some of us rode in and split them up, and after about an hour's wait, they quieted down. Then Slaughter rode in, whistling and leading his white ox at the end of a 35-foot lariat, and as he rode through them, they were so loggy that he had to quirt them out of the way. When he came to the bridge, he stopped the white wheeler until everything had quieted down. Then he led old Blanco on again, but giving him all the time he needed, and stopping every few feet. We held our breath, as one or two of the herd started to follow him, but they shied and turned back, and our hopes of the moment were crushed. Slaughter detained the ox on the bridge for a few minutes, but seeing it was useless, he dismounted and drove him back into the herd. Again and again, he tried the same ruse, but it was of no avail. Then we threw the herd back about half a mile, and on Flood's suggestion, cut off possibly 200 head, a bunch which with our numbers we ought to handle readily in spite of their will. And by putting their remuda of over 100 saddle horses in the immediate lead, made the experiment of forcing them. We took the saddle horses down and crossed and recrossed the bridge several times with them, and as the cattle came up, turned the horses into the lead and headed for the bridge. With a cordon of 20 riders around them, no animal could turn back, and the horses crossed the bridge on a trot, but the cattle turned tail and positively refused to have anything to do with it. We held them like a block in a vice, so compactly they could not even mill, but they would not cross the bridge. When it became evident that it was a fruitless effort, Jacklin, usually a very quiet man, gave vent to a fit of profanity which would have put the army in Flanders to shame. Slaughter, somewhat to our amusement, reproved him. "Don't fret, man. This is nothing. I balked a herd once in crossing a railroad track, and after trying for 2 days to cross them, had to drive him 10 miles and put them under a culvert. You want to cultivate patience, young fella, when you're handling dumb brutes." If Slaughter's cook had been thereabouts then, and suggested a means of getting that herd to take the bridge, his suggestion would have been welcomed, for the bosses were at their wits' end. Jacklin swore that he would bed that herd at the entrance and hold them until they either starved to death or crossed, before he'd let an animal turn back. But cooler heads were present, and the rebel mentioned a certain adage to the effect that when a bird or a girl, he didn't know which, could sing and wouldn't, she or it ought to be made to sing. He suggested that we hold the 4 oxen on the bridge, cut off 15 head of cattle, and give them such a running start that they wouldn't know which end their heads were on until they reached the bridge. Millet's foreman approved of the idea, for he was nursing his wrath. The 4 oxen were accordingly cut out, and Slaughter and one of his men, taking them, started for the bridge with instructions to hold them on the middle. The rest of us took about 12 head of light cattle, brought them within 100 yards of the bridge, then, with a yell, started them on a run from which they could not turn back. They struck the entrance squarely, and we had our first cattle on the bridge. 2 men held the entrance, and we brought up another bunch in the same manner, which filled the bridge. Now, we thought, if the herd could be brought up slowly, and this bridgeful let off in their lead, they might follow. To June, a herd of cattle across in this manner would have been shameful, and the foreman of the herd knew it as well as anyone present. But no one protested, so we left men to hold the entrance securely, and went back after the herd. When we got within 1/4 mile of the creek, we cut off about 200 head of their leaders, and brought them around to the rear, for amongst these leaders were certain to be the ones which had been bogged, and we wanted to have new leaders in this trial. Slaughter was on the farther end of the bridge, and could be depended on to let the oxen lead off at the opportune moment. We brought them up cautiously, and when the herd came within a few rods of the creek, the cattle on the bridge lowed to their mates in the herd, and Slaughter, considering the time favorable, opened out and allowed them to leave the bridge on the farther side. As soon as the cattle started leaving on the farther side, we dropped back, and the leaders of the herd, to the number of 12, after smelling the fresh dirt and seeing the others crossing, walked cautiously up to the bridge. It was a moment of extreme anxiety. None of us spoke a word, but the cattle, crowding off the bridge at the farther end, set it vibrating. That was enough. They turned as if panic-stricken and rushed back to the body of the herd. I was almost afraid to look at Jacklin. He could hardly speak, but he rode over to me, ashen with rage, and kept repeating, "Well, wouldn't that beat hell?" Slaughter rode back across the bridge, and the men came up and gathered around Jacqueline. We seemed to have run the full length of our rope. No one even had a suggestion to offer, and if anyone had had, it needed to be a plausible one to find approval, for hope seemed to have vanished. While discussing the situation, a one-eyed, pox-marked fellow belonging to Slaughter's outfit galloped up from the rear and said, almost breathlessly,
"Say, fellas, I see a cow and a calf in the herd. Let's rope the calf. The cow is sure to follow. Get the rope around the calf's neck, and when it chokes him, he's liable to bellow, and that'll call the steers. And if you never let up on the choking till you get on the other side of the bridge, I think it'll work. Let's try it, anyhow."
We all approved, for we knew that next to the smell of blood, nothing will stir range cattle like the bellowing of a calf. At the mere suggestion, Jacqueline's men scattered into the herd, and within a few minutes we had a rope around the neck of the calf. As the roper came through the herd leading the calf, the frantic mother followed, with a train of excited steers at her heels. And as the calf was dragged bellowing across the bridge, it was followed by excited, struggling steers, who never knew whether they were walking on a bridge or on terra firma. The excitement spread through the herd, and they were thickened around the entrance until it was necessary to hold them back, and only let enough pass to keep the chain unbroken. They were nearly a half hour in crossing, for it was fully as large a herd as ours, and when the last animal had crossed, Pete Slaughter stood up in his stirrups and led the long yell. The sun went down that day on nobody's wrath, for Jacqueline was so tickled that he offered to kill the fattest beef in his herd if we would stay overnight with him. All three of the herds were now over, but had not this herd balked on us the evening before, over 9,000 cattle would have crossed Slaughter's Bridge the day it was built. It was now late in the evening, and as we had to wait some little time to get our horses, we stayed for supper. It was dark before we set out to overtake the herd, but the trail was plain, and letting our horses take their own time, we jollied along until after midnight. We might have missed the camp, but, by the merest chance, Priest sighted our campfire a mile off the trail, though it had burned to embers. On reaching camp, we changed saddles to our night horses, and, calling officer, were ready for our watch. We were expecting the men on guard to call us any minute, and while Priest was explaining to officer the trouble we had had in crossing the millet herd, I dozed off to sleep there as I sat by the rekindled embers. In that minute's sleep, my mind wandered in a dream to my home on the San Antonio River, but the next moment I was aroused to the demands of the hour by the rebel shaking me and saying, "Wake up, Tom. Take a new hold. They're calling us on guard. If you expect to follow the trail, son, you must learn to do your sleeping in the winter." After leaving the country tributary to the Solomon River, we crossed a wide tableland for nearly 100 miles, and with the exception of the Kansas Pacific Railroad, without a landmark worthy of a name. Western Kansas was then classified, worthily too, as belonging to the Great American Desert, and most of the country for the last 500 miles of our course was entitled to a similar description. Once the freshness of spring had passed, the plain took on her natural, sunburnt color, and day after day, as far as the eye could reach, the monotony was unbroken, save by the variations of the mirages on every hand. Except at morning and evening, we were never out of sight of these optical illusions, sometimes miles away, and then again close up, when an antelope standing half a mile distant looked as tall as a giraffe. Frequently, the lead of the herd would be in eclipse from these illusions, when to the men in the rear, the horsemen and cattle in the lead would appear like giants in an old fairy story. If the monotony of the sea can be charged with dulling men's sensibilities until they become pirates, surely this desolate, arid plain might be equally charged with the wrongdoing of not a few of our craft. On crossing the railroad at Grinnell, our foreman received a letter from Lovell, directing him to go to Culbertson, Nebraska, and there meet a man who was buying horses for a Montana ranch. Our employer had his business eye open for a possible purchaser for our remuda, and if the horses could be sold for delivery after the herd had reached its destination, the opportunity was not to be overlooked. Accordingly, on reaching Beaver Creek, where we camped, Flood left us to ride through to the Republican River during the night. The trail crossed the river about 20 miles west of Culbertson, and if the Montana horse buyer was yet there, it would be no trouble to come up to the trail crossing and look at our horses. So, after supper, and while we were catching up our night horses, Flood said to us,
"Now, boys, I'm going to leave the outfit and herd under Joe Stallings as a segundo. It's hardly necessary to leave you under anyone as foreman, for you all know your places. But someone must be made responsible, and one bad boss will do less harm than half a dozen that mightn't agree. So, you can put Honeyman on guard in your place at night, Joe, if you don't want to stand your watch. Now behave yourselves, and when I meet you on the Republican, I'll bring out a box of cigars and have it charged up as axle grease when we get supplies at Ogallala. And don't sit up all night telling fool stories."
"Now that's what I call a good cow boss," said Joe Stallings, as our foreman rode away in the twilight. "Besides, he used passable good judgment in selecting a segundo. Now, Honeyman, you heard what he said. Billy, dear, I won't rob you of this chance to stand a guard. McCann, have you got on your next list of supplies any jam and jelly for Sundays? You have? That's right, son. That saves you from standing a guard tonight. Officer, when you come off guard at 3:30 a.m. in the morning, build the cook up a good fire. Let me see. Yes, and I'll detail young Tom Quirk and the Rebel to grease the wagon and harness your mules before starting in the morning. I want to impress it on your mind, McCann, that I can appreciate a thoughtful cook. What's that, Honeyman? No, indeed, you can't ride my night horse. Love me, love my dog. My horse shares this snap. Now, I don't want to be under the necessity of speaking to any of you first guard, but flop into your saddles ready to take the herd. My turnip says it's 8 o'clock now."
"Why, you've missed your calling. You'd make a fine second mate on a river steamboat, driving Cajuns," called back Quince Forrest as the first guard rode away.
When our guard returned, Officer intentionally walked across Stallings' bed and, catching his spur in the tarpaulin, fell heavily across our segundo.
"Excuse me," said John, rising, "but I was just nosing around looking for the foreman."
"Oh, it's you, is it? I just wanted to ask if 4:30 wouldn't be plenty early to build up the fire. Wood's a little scarce, but I'll burn the prairies if you say so."
"That's all I wanted to know. You may lay down now and go to sleep."
Our campfire that night was a good one, and in the absence of Flood, no one felt like going to bed until drowsiness compelled us. So, we lounged around the fire smoking the hours away, and in spite of the admonition of our foreman, told stories far into the night. During the early portion of the evening, dog stories occupied the boards. As the evening wore on, the subject of revisiting the old states came up for discussion.
"You all talk about going back to the old states," said Joe Stallings, "but I don't take very friendly to the idea. I felt that way once and went home to Tennessee. But I want to tell you that after you live a few years in the sunny Southwest and get into her ways, you can't stand it back there like you think you can. Now, when I went back, and I reckon my relations will average up pretty well, fought in the Confederate Army, vote the Democratic ticket, and belong to the Methodist Church, they all seem to be rapidly getting locoed. Why, my uncles, when they think of planting the old buck field on the widow's acre into any crop, they first go projecting around in the soil, and as they say, analyze it, to see what kind of fertilizer it'll require to produce the best results. Back there, if one man raises 10 acres of corn, and his neighbor raises 12, the one raising 12 is sure to look upon the other as though he lacked enterprise or had modest ambitions. Now, up around that old cow town, Abilene, Kansas, it's a common sight to see the cornfields stretch out like an ocean. And then there's stock. They're all locoed about that, too. Why, I know people will pay $100 for siring a colt. And if there's one drop of mongrel blood in that sire's veins for 10 generations back on either side of his ancestral tree, it condemns him, though he may be a good horse otherwise. They are strong on standard-bred horses. But as for me, my mount is all right. I wouldn't trade with any man in this outfit, without it would be Flood, and there's none of them standard-bred either. Why, shucks! If you had to pick all the standard-bred horses in Tennessee, you couldn't handle a herd of cattle like ours with them without carrying a commissary with you to feed them. No, they'd never fit in here. Takes a range-bred horse to run cattle, one that can rustle and live on grass. Another thing about those people back in the old states, not one in 10, I'll gamble, knows the teacher he sends his children to school to. But when he has a promising colt to be shod, the owner goes to the blacksmith shop himself, and he and the smith will sit on the back sill of the shop, and they'll discuss how to shoe that filly so as to give her certain knee action which she seems to need. Probably, says one, a little weight on her toe would give her reach, and there they will sit and powwow and make medicine for an hour or two. And while the blacksmith is shoeing her, the owner will tell him in confidence what a wonderful burst of speed she developed yesterday while he was speeding her on the back stretch. And then, just as he turned her into the home stretch, she threw a shoe and he had to check her in. But if there'd been anyone to catch her time, he was certain it was better than a 210 clip. And that same colt, you couldn't cut a lame cow out of the shade of a tree on her. A man back there, he's rich, too, though his father made it. Gave $1,000 for a pair of dogs before they were born. The terms are one half cash, and the balance when they were old enough to ship to him. And for fear they were not the proper mustard, he had that dog man sue him in court for the balance, so as to make him prove the pedigree. Now Bob here thinks that the old hound of his is real stuff, but he wouldn't do now. Almost every year the style changes in dogs back in the old states. One year, maybe it's a little white dog with red eyes, and the very next, it's a long, bench-legged black dog with a Dutch name that right now I disremember. Common old pot hounds and everyday yellow dogs have gone out of style entirely. Now, you can all go back that want to, but as long as I can hold a job with Lovell and Flood, I'll try and worry along my own way. On finishing his little yarn, Stallings arose, saying, I must take a listen to my men on herd. It always frets me, for fear my men will ride too near the cattle. A minute later, he called us, and when several of us walked out to where he was listening, we recognized Roundtree's voice singing. Little black bull, come down the hillside, down the hillside, down the hillside. Little black bull came down the hillside long time ago. Whenever my men sing that song on guard, Tells me that everything is amply serene, remarked our segundo, with the air of a field marshal, as he walked back to the fire. The evening had passed so rapidly, it was now almost time for the second guard to be called, and when the lateness of the hour was announced, we scurried to our blankets like rabbits to their warrens. The second guard usually got an hour or two of sleep before being called, but in the absence of our regular foreman, the mice would play. When our guard was called at 1 a.m., as usual, officer delayed us several minutes looking for his spurs, and I took the chance to ask the rebel why it was that he never wore spurs.
"It's because I'm superstitious, son," he answered. "I own a fine pair of silver-plated spurs that have a history, and if you're ever at Lovell's Ranch, I'll show them to you. They were given to me by a mortally wounded federal officer the day the Battle of Lookout Mountain was fought. I was an orderly, carrying dispatches, and in passing through a wood from which the Union Army had been recently driven, this officer was sitting at the root of a tree, fatally wounded. He motioned me to him, and when I dismounted, he said, 'Johnny Reb, please give a dying man a drink.' I gave him my canteen, and after drinking from it, he continued, 'I want you to have my spurs. Take them off. Listen to their history. As you have taken them off me today, so I took them off a Mexican general the day the American army entered the capital of Mexico.'" The outfit was awakened out of sleep the next morning by shouts of,
"Ho, mula! Ho, you mongrel outcasts! Catch them blankety-blank mules!"
accompanied by a rattle of chain harness. And Quince Forrest dashed across our segundo's bed, shaking a harness in each hand. We kicked the blankets off and came to our feet in time to see the offender disappear behind the wagon, while Stallings sat up and yawningly inquired,
"What other blowcoat fool had got funny?"
But the camp was awake, for the cattle were leisurely leaving the bed ground, while Honeyman, who had been excused from the herd the first sign of dawn, was rustling up the horses in the valley of the Beaver below camp. With the understanding that the Republican River was a short 3 days' drive from our present camp, the herd trailed out the first day with not an incident to break the monotony of eating and sleeping, grazing and guarding. But near noon of the second day, we were overtaken by an old, long-whiskered man and a boy of possibly 15. They were riding in a light, rickety vehicle, drawn by a small Spanish mule and a rough but clean-limbed bay mare. The strangers appealed to our sympathy, for they were guileless in appearance, and asked so many questions, indicating that ours might have been the first herd of trail cattle they had ever seen. The old man was a free talker, and innocently allowed us to inveigle it out of him that he had been down on the North Beaver, looking for land to homestead, and was then on his way up to take a look at the lands along the Republican. We invited him and the boy to remain for dinner, for in that monotonous waste, we would have been only too glad to entertain a bandit, or an angel for that matter, provided he would talk about something else than cattle. In our guest, however, we found a good conversationalist, meaty with stories not eligible to the retired list, and in return, the hospitality of our wagon was his and welcome. The travel-stained old rascal proved to be a good mixer, and before dinner was over, he had won us to a man, though Stallings, in the capacity of foreman, felt it incumbent on him to act the host in behalf of the outfit. In the course of the conversation, the old man managed to unearth the fact that our acting foreman was a native of Tennessee, and when he had got it down to town and county, claimed acquaintance with a family of men in that locality who were famed as breeders of racehorses. Our guest admitted that he himself was a native of that state, and in his younger days had been a devotee of the racecourse, with the name of every horseman in that commonwealth, as well as the bluegrass regions of Kentucky, on his tongue's end.
but adversity had come upon him, and now he was looking out a new country in which to begin life over again. After dinner, when our remuda was corralled to catch fresh mounts, our guest bubbled over with admiration of our horses and pointed out several as promising speed and action. We took his praise of our horse flesh as quite a compliment, never suspecting flattery at the hands of this nomadic patriarch. He innocently inquired which was considered the fastest horse in Bermuda when Stallings pointed out a brown, belonging to Flood's mount, as the best quarter horse in the band. He gave him a critical examination and confessed he would never have picked him for a horse possessing speed, though he admitted he was unfamiliar with range-raised horses, this being his first visit in the West. Stallings offered to loan him a horse out of his mount, and as the old man had no saddle, our segundo prevailed on McCann to loan his for the afternoon. I'm inclined to think that there was a little jealousy amongst us this afternoon as to who was best entitled to entertain our company, and while he showed no partiality, Stallings seemed to monopolize his countrymen to our disadvantage. The two jollied along from point to rear and back again, and as they passed us riders in the swing, Stallings ignored us entirely, though the old man always had a pleasant word to say as he rode by. And that concludes today's chapters of The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days, by Andy Adams. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw. My head.